Welcome to Career Tours. This week, authenticity and professionalism, part two. Questions this cast answers are, which is better, being authentic or being professional? Are authenticity and professionalism mutually exclusive? Manager Tours will be in Europe, in Frankfurt, on the 7th and 8th of February. If your organisation could benefit from our Effective Manager, Effective Communicator or Effective Hiring Manager client training, this is the time to book your work. Because if you pair your training with when we'll be in Europe, there's a significant cost reduction in the travel costs for the clients. And we still have some openings to work with your teams. So if you would like that, please contact Maggie at maggie@manager-tools.com to learn how we can customize your training and for more specifics. And if there's only a couple of you, look at the website and register for Frankfurt. Authenticity is a personal desire and it doesn't trump the needs of the organization. There's a difference between the organization's needs, wants, desires and your personal ones. And you are one person amongst the size of the organization. And so your needs don't get to trump those of the organizations. There are structures and formulas that are known to work in organizations and you're being asked to follow them. Rarely does anybody, in fact, I've never heard anybody complain that the standardized method of payroll offends their authenticity. And yet there are people who find it most helpful or find it most pleasing to their character to use cash in a way that I don't. Yeah. I never have cash. But some people have cash, they have cash envelopes, and that's the way they budget and it makes most sense to them and it's their way of doing things.
And it works. It's their way of doing things. And they have the authority to do things their way in their home.
Exactly. But they don't say, hey, the company has to pay me in cash. I go to HR and they give me an envelope and it's cash. They accept the fact that the money goes to their bank and they have to go to the bank or the ATM and take that cash out in order then to assert their wish, their need, their authenticity to work on a cash basis for their own budget. They don't say, oh, no, don't bother paying me because I don't like a credit transaction. They say, yes, I will take money anytime you give it to me, any way you give it to me, and then I'll make it work.
Right. And they understand that not everybody can have it their own way. And so they accept some reasonable accommodation for the different ways people interact with, feel about, think about money. But the way we behave, what we wear, the thoughts we express, somehow, at the same time, those things are excluded from the accommodation we allow the organization. But in fact, the organization puts those in the exact same category. And as you said, authenticity has, as individualism has, increased over the years. And it has become imbued with a moral component. And this is regrettable, unfortunately. It's become one of the highest values. It's almost become a virtue, the way courage and ethics are. And if it goes to that level where it's a virtue, then no one wants to assail someone for asserting their authenticity. And so people say, well, because I'm being authentic, I get to be excused from rules that are applied to everyone else because that's not the authentic me to follow that rule. An introverted person says, I can't be high energy and charismatic when I present. It's not authentic for me, so you'll just have to get used to my form of presenting. Well, you can try that, but you'll get less effective results because the long-standing knowledge of humans interacting in organizational life is high energy, charismatic presenters outperform those who don't, whether you like it or not. And in fact, in this particular case, it's not a question of whether you like it or don't like it. You're saying I'm simply inflexible and choose only to do what I know how to do, which is, by the way, a terrible thing to say about someone who wants to grow in responsibility. Because if you're going to grow in responsibility, you're going to grow in your behavioral set as well. Your behavior set is going to get wider and deeper and so on. But if you're saying I'm authentic and I won't change in that regard, you're essentially saying, and you should worry about what other things I won't change in regard to. And therefore, I have to say to you, how much can I trust you with more authority and responsibility? Because I don't know what authority, I don't have a list of what new authorities and responsibilities you get in this new job I'm considering you for. But I can't, every single time I promote someone, have them give me a checklist of what they're authentic about and what they're not authentic about, and therefore how many of those things bump up negatively against the criteria for the job that they say they want because they want to get paid more. It's a nightmare.
And the difference between asking someone to lie, which is unethical, which is a moral virtue, and just saying to someone, please talk louder and faster when you present, they're worlds apart. When you just said about courage, I thought my granddad was in the Second World War fighting against Nazism. There's a big difference between his courage and you wearing a t-shirt with a political slogan. Like,
yeah, that's really good.
Right? They're worlds apart. And this is the same thing. It's just asking you to talk differently is not a moral judgment, nor does it have a moral component.
No, it's not immoral to ask an employee to use certain words and avoid other words. In our guidance on authenticity in the Manager Tools cast, I pointed out that at Starbucks, customers comply with the rules, in that they ask for the size of drink first and the drink next, and then the additions afterwards. We have learned it's a cultural adaptation that's the fastest way to get what you want at Starbucks. The reverse of that is also true. The staff at Starbucks all ask for your order, repeat it back to you, tell you what to do next, and so on, in the same words. Good morning. What can I get started for you? It's not the same question that you're asked at McDonald's. There they say, hi, my name is Mark. What can I get for you? I think I just wrote in Things We Think that at In-N-Out, I think they say, hello, how are you today? They have tried hundreds of different ways, and they've learned that's the best to ensure an efficient and pleasant customer interaction. Now, some of you are going, wait, that's minimum wage. You have to tell them exactly what to do. Otherwise, there'd be a free-for-all. Who knows what would happen?
That made that point for us. Thank you very much.
There have to be rules. Otherwise, there's pandemonium. And no, this doesn't just apply to entry-level people. And Starbucks is not talking down to those baristas. In fact, if you listen to any executive at Starbucks who knows anything about their culture and having had them as a client, I know exactly what I'm talking about here. They revere the baristas. One of the things Howard Schultz told a group that I was in once, he says, at Walmart, the most powerful people are not in Bentonville, which is the headquarters in Arkansas. The most powerful people are the managers running the stores. And it doesn't matter who you are at Walmart. If you have an opinion X and five store managers say, no, we disagree with X, X is not happening. And you might be a senior VP or whatever, but the store managers are, in a way, kind of running things. And Howard Schultz says, you know, when it comes to it, our baristas are kind of like Walmart store managers. They're hugely important. They're our front line. And we're going to pay attention very closely to what they do. And there was a lot of input. And in fact, that process of ordering things and so on has changed over the years. They pay attention to feedback and so on. And that's the way you do it. And if you're going to be a barista, that's the way it's done. And if you don't want to do it that way, because it would be better and more authentic for you to do it differently, sorry, you can't work at Starbucks.
And it's not just about the customer interaction. It's also about the efficiency of the machine. Like, they have something ridiculous, like 20 seconds when you get to the drive-through window to take your money and to give you what you need. And then you're supposed to be gone. So if they are not following those rules for what they say, they can't achieve that goal. And then the line is too long.
Right. And then, well, here's the other side of that coin. Then I've had people say, oh, it's just corporate greed. No, it's not. They're trying to serve as many people as possible. Exactly. It's not greed, folks. I got to tell you, the people at Starbucks are not greedy. They want to serve as many people as possible. People love Starbucks. Those people sit in line at Starbucks and they don't want them to have to go somewhere else because the people at Starbucks are not efficient and courteous and know how to do their job. And why wouldn't we want them to do the job as fast and efficiently as possible? If everyone got to do the job their own way, again, it would be pandemonium. Look at it another way. Companies want to be able to hire the best of employees. If you hire someone good, that good person is not going to sit still for a bunch of petty rules and a dictator tyrant bosses. They're not. The loss of good employees to that kind of micromanagement or meddling or force feeding or top-down heavy-handed culture, that's a risk to the companies. Companies don't want to do that. They have as few rules as they can possibly get away with to be effective.
Otherwise, you just have to employ more people to enforce them. And That's a waste of corporate resources.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. So before deciding whether you want to break company norms in pursuit of being your authentic self, you might want to consider whether your authentic self is your best work self. So Tiger Woods is described as the best natural golfer there's ever been, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And he won three PGA. I looked this up because I wouldn't know this. He won three PGA tournaments the year he turned pro, and he's had two hiatuses and a serious car crash, and yet people still think he will win. And yet he has also changed his swing four times. Even though he's the best natural golfer there's ever been, he's always had a coach because his natural authentic self can be better.
Yeah. Now, if you were Tiger Woods, would you tell your coach you wanted to stick with your authentic swing when that means maybe winning only a small proportion of the tournaments that you play in? Right? I mean, however much money he's won, let's say he's had four different swings over his career, you're going to take 25% of that rather than 100% of that? Right? Now, you might say, well, he still might have won them. Yeah, but that's not the way the world works. There's no might haves in the world. You can do that all you want on your couch late at night. But, you know, if only this had happened, then I'd be great. So before you decide to always be yourself, consider whether you could be even more successful by changing some of your behaviors.
So now we've set up the idea with some general comments. We're going to talk about three specific examples. And there's, of course, there's
more.
Way yeah. more. And we'll talk about them in the future. And if you want to suggest one that you'd like us to cover, feel free to email us at customerservice@manager-tools.com.
Yeah.
So we're going to start with what you wear. One thing that people mention often is what they want to wear to work and whether or not it's authentic, comfortable, whether or not it's the colours they want to wear, all of those things. And the authenticists, which is a word I think
I just invented.
But anyway.
You just got it. You got it exactly right. Authenticists.
They believe that they should be able to wear whatever they want because being comfortable makes them more productive and therefore outweighs other considerations. But people have an expectation of you based on what you're wearing.
Well, the authenticists would say they oughtn't. Like, yeah, okay, but that's not how human beings work. They do, whether you want them to or not. Well, they're wrong. I said, well, okay, but there's 7 billion of them, right? And when 7 billion people are wrong, actually, what ends up happening is that becomes right.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Look, in humankind's entire history, we have always encouraged, and in many cases, before the relatively recent onset of massive human freedom, we have always encouraged, and again, in history, mandated what people wear in the public square. And a corporation is a version of the public square. And it relates to your work, and it relates to the role you have, and so on. I just mentioned freedom. I told this to somebody the other day and they were shocked. So folks, let me be clear about this. The freedom you have today in the world is a relatively recent occurrence in humankind. Up until about 250 years ago, the world was not free. If you were a subject in a country that was ruled by a king, everything belonged to the king and or queen, and they could take whatever they wanted. You probably didn't have property rights. You couldn't say what you wanted to say. You couldn't go where you wanted to go without a by your leave from some functionary in the king's or the sovereign's form of government, whatever it might be. Freedom is relatively new. And yet, the cultural adaptations about what we wear have existed for thousands of years. And so we have this conflict between these newfound freedoms and the cultural adaptations that it kept us from killing each other all the time.
So let's talk about somebody who we know has a role that people have a very clear understanding of what their role is in the world. So doctors, we all know what a doctor does, and we have a clear understanding of what we expect from them. So until about 1900, doctors only wore black. They didn't have white coats. They had black ones. And it wasn't because they wanted to hide the blood because they were doing, you know, nasty surgeries or anything. It was because black was considered suitable for formal attire, like a dinner suit or an evening gown.
Yeah. It was a serious thing to be a doctor.
Yeah. It was a symbol of their formality, not, you know, practical.
Right.
And more recently, doctors wore white coats. I know they don't a lot in hospitals now, but they wore white coats. They don't wear them when they're off duty, because that coat is a symbol that you can expect certain things from them, that they'll take care of your health, that they won't do you any harm, that they'll do their best to help you. When a doctor is not wearing her white coat, for example, in an airport when they're changing flights, she's not obliged to help someone who is having some medical crisis. Will. They probably will. Yeah, but they're not obliged. And because they're not wearing the white coat, no one expects them to. When you walk into your doctor's surgery and you see the person in the white coat, you think that's the doctor, and you have a list of expectations about them. When you see the nurse, they have a different uniform on and you have a different set of expectations.
Yeah, I need to help Americans who are listening to Wendy's British English, that when she says doctor's surgery, what she means is clinic.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. That's what they call it. I watched Doc Martin, many episodes of Doc Martin. And of course, they always talk about the surgery is closed, which every American, it just stoves our head in, the idea that, well, he's not doing surgery. Surgery's cutting people open. Yes, no, but a surgery is a clinic, and vice versa.
Yes. Yeah. I can't believe I've lived it 11 years and I still have things that happen like that.
Yeah, and yet your mom and dad say that you sound very American.
I sound very American. Yeah, and part of that is, to go back to Starbucks, the word is croissant. And by the way, that is not a chocolate croissant. It's a pain au chocolat. Croissants are crescent-shaped. Yeah. But if you want a chocolate croissant in Starbucks, you have to say chocolate croissant. Otherwise, you don't get what you want. I have found out this the hard way. I have adapted. It's inauthentic because it's not who I am. I am a person with a British accent. I am also a person who wants the chocolate croissant.
Yeah. Well, I would actually say, when you say it's inauthentic, I would say, no, that's not true. You behaving in a way that gets you what you want, which is not natural to you, that is not inauthenticity. It's not. It is an adaptation. Some people are wanting to call it inauthentic and then elevate that to a moral virtue such that it cannot be assailed, but that's what this cast is about. They're wrong. But look, most of us don't have such consistent requirements for what we wear at work, but we still have at home and at work clothes. And most of us would probably recognize in most situations whether somebody's wearing clothes that are suitable for work. Someone seeing you in your at-home clothes while you were at work will be justified in assuming that you're not working. You're just coming to pick something up in the office or something. What you choose to wear also sends a message about your attitude towards the activity you're doing. If you turn up to a baseball game wearing heels and a ball gown, we can assume you're not going to work that hard to run down the ball, however much you say you will, right? By the same analogy, when you turn up to work in board shorts and a t-shirt, your colleagues are justified in assuming you're bringing the right attitude for the beach, but the wrong attitude for productivity. You may disagree with that and say, well, I actually can be productive like this. But your colleagues, who understand that there are some assumptions we make and some adaptations we make for working in close quarters with other people who may not want to see your hairy legs, you know, there is going to be an effect on them.
And here's the rub in that. You make assumptions based on what people are wearing too. You can't claim that it's not fair that people do this when you do it too. And when you're in a store and you need someone to help you, how do you distinguish the person who's going to help you from all of the other customers? You look for the uniform, and sometimes they don't wear a uniform. They just wear the same color t-shirt or something similar. There's not always a badge, but somehow you know the difference between the customers and the store clerks. Yep. And you can do that because we make judgments about people based on what they're wearing all day long, all of us.
Yeah. And again, none of this requires you to be inauthentic. The ability, the requirement to meet a fairly relaxed dress code compared to my career, what my dress code has been in the last 30 years, it's not a question of your authenticity. You're not, certainly not asked to put on somebody else's clothes. You're not asked to wear a white coat if you're not a doctor, or the store uniform if you don't work there. You can be dressed suitably for work and be authentic. You can be suitably dressed for work and be comfortable. You just have to consider the entire range of potential clothing choices rather than that which you feel good at home. Yeah, I would suggest to everyone that if you wish to make a stand about your authenticity, clothes would not be the way to do it. I honor you for you having the courage, the courage of your convictions, but there's a long established human pattern of behavior around people working together and therefore having some general dress code rules. Although we at Manager Tools are against dress codes completely. We think managers, there ought to be a dress code. The dress code should say managers will make a decision about whether someone is dressed appropriately. And there will be essentially different dress codes in different places. And a vice president may have to say to one manager who decides he's going to fly his beach flag that your people, I'm sorry, you made a bad choice. And I have now removed your ability to make a dress code choice. You're in my organization. You're going to adapt my organization's dress code, which is this.
We're always telling you that January is the time when the job market is most liquid. Most people are moving around, so there's a way higher chance right now that you are thinking about a new job, changing jobs, or that people in your team or people you know are changing jobs. And that's why we're going to remind you about the interviewing series. It's everything we know about interviewing in a podcast product, and it's available as part of a personal license. So you can get the interviewing series and all the benefits of a personal license all in one go. That's one less thing to worry about as you change jobs. Go to the website and look under products for personal license or the interviewing series. Our next example is how you behave. So we've said for years in Manager Tools, you've said for years in Manager Tools and Career Tools that human organizations are the greatest achievement of humankind, and that
yes,
our organizations multiply the effectiveness of one person to produce goods and services that we could never do alone. There's 150,000 people at Apple and they produce the iPhone, and 150,000 people working on their own would never have done that. You need people working together.
Yeah. And you've also heard me say many times, the definition of conflict is two human beings in the same county. By the way, Wendy, I will now admit to you that I gave my dad credit for that, because my dad grew up when I was a kid. I have three brothers, and my dad's favorite phrase is, I'm not going to argue with you, mainly because my dad is a sweet guy. Everyone who meets my dad likes him, but also because he didn't have to argue with us because he was the father. He was a very big guy and we were scared of him. He was a wonderful man. Love him to death. But he did not teach me the definition of conflict. Well, he did not. I always said it's my dad. Actually, he just inspired it. But that line is actually mine. The definition of conflict is two human beings in the same county. And if there's going to be conflict, we need rules of behavior in order to live and work effectively together. That's what culture is. Human adaptation with thousands of tiny, tiny, tiny interactions. Folks, this is why the Soviet Union collapsed. I hate to be geopolitical, but it's true that the Soviet Union collapsed because they attempted to impose culture on people. And when I tell this story, a lot of people say, well, that's companies imposing their culture on me. No, actually, that's not. You have it wrong. The Soviet Union imposed a culture on people and said, we know how much you should grow. And that's why there were famines and starvation and so on, because they treated their people like serfs. They had ultimate control. They killed many millions of people. Stalin certainly did under the Soviet regime. But those Soviets, those people living in the Soviet Union, did not have the ability of free association. They could not leave. They built the Berlin Wall to prove it. You can't leave. We're going to keep you in. We need you to work. You have free association at your company. You can leave. It may be a great job. You may really like it. But if you have problems with the company, you may need to go. And you have the great, wonderful freedom of association, and you can choose to leave and go somewhere else. So basically, in order to work together, we need to sometimes subordinate our own wishes to those of the group in order for the group to be more effective as a whole. I've said this before. You pay an organization tax, right? 30% roughly against the total potential productivity of the people in the organization. A big part of that is the communication that happens between individuals in the organization. Some people say, well, I'm not a communicator. It doesn't matter. I love you. When you're at home, you don't have to talk to your spouse. You're not a communicator. That's okay. When you're at work, it is required. The organization does not run based on the org chart. It's based on human beings doing things and talking to one another about it. That is at the heart of all human organizations. Nobody talks about it. I don't know why. Organizations are not charts. I like to tell people if they were charts, we would call them a mechanization, meaning they're mechanical, but they're not. They're an organization. They're full of organisms, and organisms interact with one another. And the way we interact today in the world, as in our present human form, is verbal communication largely, and then also written communication.
There was a study at, I'm going to get this all wrong, but I think it was a study at IBM where they looked at the organization chart, and then they created a sort of a real version and showed where the power lay. And it, of course, it was nothing like the organization chart, but the way they measured it was the amount of communication between people.
Sure. The emails. Oh, this is, there are companies that do that. They just go in and read emails. They measure emails and they discover where the lines of communication are. It is amazing to me that people don't get that when we say these things, I suppose I should understand it, but I still don't. And I guess fool me twice, shame on me. That the company knows they're asking people to give up a little bit of their individuality in order to get this massive increase, that you actually have to choose to subordinate yourself to everyone else, even though everyone else is just like you. But magically, something happens, which is why sociologists say that human organizations are our greatest achievement. It massively increases the sum total of what that organization can do. Now, this is a classic concept called the law of sub-optimization, which basically says if there is an organism or an organization which is made up of sub-components, that in order to maximize the success of the entire organization, the sub-components must be sub-maximized. What most people would say is, no. What you should do is let each of those subcomponents do everything it possibly can. And then, of course, the totality of everything, we just add it all together. And then there would be the larger organization would do better, of course. That's not how it works.
If my heart beats as hard as it can,
you're going to die pretty fast.
The rest of me dies.
Yeah. So in order to be highly successful as an organization, you have to have your subcomponents, which essentially ultimately are individuals, be sub-maximized. If everybody achieves their own maximum, the organization will suffer. It'll essentially be chaos. And so if your authentic behavior approach, if you believe that not communicating a lot is your authentic way of doing things, you're hurting the company and you're violating one of the rules, which is we assume everybody has to communicate with everyone else. And you shouldn't be surprised if that means that your authenticity puts you at risk of unemployment, because that's exactly what it does. And we don't want that to happen to you.
Every group of people who've interacted with each other since the beginning of time has created a certain set of arbitrary rules that they expected everyone to live by.
Culture.
Andrew and I recorded earlier this week, we were talking about baboons and how if you watch a nature program, they say, this is the rules of being in this baboon colony, and they can't even talk, and yet they create rules for themselves. You know, when you get humans together, experience shows us that we need rules in order to live together, because otherwise we know how to behave, we just don't. And every religion has something akin to thou shalt not kill for a reason. It had to be said out loud. And I was reading a review of the medical code of ethics from the first ones from the American Medical Association. And the guy was saying about rules of people, and he said, even the least law-abiding abide by rules, because honor among thieves has become a proverb. In other words, the people that are breaking the rules of society have rules about their behavior between themselves. So that just goes to prove it.
Yeah, the only thing I would argue with about what you just said is you said, since the beginning of time, human beings have created a certain set of arbitrary rules. The rules aren't arbitrary. People want to complain about corporations that they have arbitrary rules. They're not arbitrary, folks. They're well-intentioned, and they're well-researched, and they're well-positioned in order to maximize productivity so we can serve more people, so we can make more people's lives outside of our company better. You have to agree to subordinate yourself to something that will massively magnify your impact on the world. You can decide to follow the rules or you can dismiss them. But if you dismiss them, there's consequences. And, you know, it's interesting. We talk about rules. The other side of that coin is laws, mm-hmm. which is a very different thing, because now there are really significant consequences. One of the reasons we vote people into office, so we can vote them out if we no longer favor them. We want that. Abiding by being voted in implies they'll also be, they'll abide by being voted out. And they know that if they got voted in, people were telling them, and this is what we expect you to do. And if you don't do it, we're going to get rid of you.
And why did political systems come in over kings and queens? Because you couldn't vote the king out, and people didn't like that.
Yeah, they didn't. They wanted a say, but they don't get complete say. The rules of society basically work the same way. We have expectations so that when someone doesn't meet them, we can remove them from our little portion of society. When we get married, we have expectations of behavior that's acceptable. And if one of the other partner doesn't meet them, we get the ability to divorce them if we want to remove them from our lives, as painful as it is. It's not the result we want, but there's a method to do that if it becomes necessary, and the workplace is no different. We have expectations. When someone doesn't meet them, the organization can remove them. You can argue that's not fair. It's funny because you drive and you follow the rules of the road when you're driving and understand your spouse will divorce you if you don't live up to her expectations. But somehow we think that we go to work, we should be able to set all of our own rules, when in fact our life is surrounded by scenarios in which we accept the rules that are put upon us. If we live in an apartment building, we can't make as much noise as we want whenever we want. When we take our kids to school, we can't cut to the front of the line without, at some point, if you're in a private school, being told your kid is no longer enrolled here.
One of the reasons we see that there's a problem with authenticity versus professionalism is organizations trying to retain individuals by saying, we support authenticity. And at the same time, they penalize people who do not abide by these unwritten and undefined expectations of dress and behavior and so on. And it's that conflict of saying one thing and doing another that causes the conflict, not the rules in and of themselves.
Yeah, well said. Okay, so our last item is your passions.
So when it comes to passions, we have to consider the trap that lies between authenticity and being disrespectful. And we fully support your right to have passions. We have them too. Mark, if I just look at the Zoom from where we're recording, I can see golf paraphernalia behind him, because Mark loves golf. And if you look on mine, I have a penguin. There's penguins everywhere. And there's at least one in view in my office. But we don't bring that into conversations about company finances, except when golf clubs or penguins have been purchased, then of course it's in finances. But otherwise, there's no reason or helpfulness to mention the things we're passionate about during a financial meeting. Our passions aren't secret. Everybody knows Wendy likes penguins. We are being authentically ourselves and professional.
At the same time. Right.
Yes, exactly.
And it's possible for your passion to be disrespectful, to become disrespectful to other people. You can be an environmental activist when you're not at work. You can gently encourage other people to be more environmentally friendly in the workplace. And I think that's actually a really good thing to do. Waste is bad in all aspects, right? You can ask the company to make easy or relatively easy decisions or cost neutral decisions about purchase based on environmental factors. You can speak up if the CEO has a town hall and you make that recommendation. But you can also go too far with that. I think, Wendy, you just mentioned that there was a workplace where environmental stuff went too far. An employee presented a proposal to remove all plastic bottles from the company. And the colleague asked the practical questions. Would they need to purchase a refillable water bottle for every member of the staff? Would there be water bottles for visitors? Showing respect for visitors included being able to offer them water. And so if the company agreed to remove all the plastic bottles, they needed an alternative. This environmental activist, who's completely justified in her beliefs, but maybe applying them a little bit recklessly inside a culture of a company, she saw, and even in this discussion, a total lack of support of something that was important to her. And yet at the same time, on the other side of the coin, the company was appalled at her lack of understanding about the practical implications, respect for colleagues, respect for company's customers. This is a case where there was a mismatch between one person's quest for authenticity in the form of her social activism, which is to be applauded and thanked that we have the freedom to do that, and its conflict with the company's requirements for their staff and customers. I love that story. I just love it. We want people to have patience. We want you to feel strongly. We want you to live out your freedom that has been purchased for you by the death of other people. And we want you to use it responsibly. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something in all contexts and situations.
The dichotomy between authenticity and professionalism is a false one. To say yes, you have to be one or the other is a false argument. It is possible to be both authentic and professional. And part of working in an organization is accepting that there are rules in order to allow all of us to work together harmoniously and successfully. And some of them are unwritten, and some of them may not suit you. And if they don't suit you and you do not feel able to be authentic in the way that you want to, we encourage you to find somewhere else to work where you can. It is helpful to neither you nor the company for you to be in conflict.
And we would suggest that for many people, this discussion about the conflict is probably not worthy of that level of concern, that the vast majority of things in our experience that are asserted as authenticity are actually not. They're just personal preferences. And in fact, if you will start thinking of it that way, you'll see less conflict, and you may, in fact, then feel better about the place you work and be able to achieve results and retention and get more and more results in relationships and have more and more responsibility over what the company does, and maybe, in fact, be able to change it at some point.
Thanks for being here, Mark. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Wendy. Thanks so much for having me on Career Tools.
That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with a new topic. Bye, everyone.